Recording.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this Minnesota Court of Appeals panel for oral arguments this August 1, 2024. We are hearing cases this morning by Zoom, an interactive internet link. Counsel, I'll just go over our rules real quickly just to remind you. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes for appellant's counsel if you choose to use it. And I should indicate the first case we're hearing this morning is in the matter of the welfare of the child, TMA, the child of TMA and MJR. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument with an additional five for appellant's counsel that you may use for a rebuttal. Although we can see each other and we have names on the screen, we're only making an audio recording of the presentation today. So please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so that it's available to the public. And with that, counsel or appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, everyone. May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Thompson. I represent Appellant TMA. There are several issues before the court this morning. However, overarching are appellant's due process rights and some questions of the constitutionality and applicability of freedom of contract and the application of due process to child protection matters. Also, in the state of Minnesota, also the precedential influence of or applicability of TPR law or termination of parental rights precedent to transfer of permanent legal and physical custody. I did ask in my brief for the court to issue some precedential opinion on those questions because there is a dearth of case law on transfers of permanent legal and physical custody, which I tend to talk fast. Then I say TPLPC. So if that's what I say, that's what I mean. I am asking that we get some more case law on TPLPCs in Minnesota going forward for this kind of appeal. In the case at bar, TMA was involved in a prior CHIPS case, which was used for the bulk of the reasoning and factual basis for the case that's being appealed here today, the transfer that's being appealed here today. That matter was in 2022. And in fact, in its brief, the agency relies primarily on old facts from 2022 to argue that the agency made reasonable efforts at reunification. They further use old facts to argue that it's in the best interest of the child for this transfer to occur. Those are two of the issues that are being challenged by appellant here, that there is a best interest, a substantial evidence to make a best interest finding, and that the agency made reasonable efforts. The agency cites the case's procedural history dating back to 2022 as reasonable efforts. The court's action and the findings that were made and the hearings that were held do not constitute reasonable efforts at rehabilitation or reunification, yet that is primarily what the agency relies on. Also, the facts regarding the best interests of the child that he be permanently separated from his father's custody are primarily citing back to issues from 2022. It's important to note that the child's health, his chemical dependency, his behavioral issues were ongoing at the time of trial in the instant case. The issues that the agency cites from 2022 were ongoing in the foster home that became the permanent custodian. So it's the appellant's position that it could not possibly be in the child's best interest to be transferred out of his custody when he was continually at risk in the foster home. From there, I'd like to focus on the issues. Yes, Your Honor.
We were to issue a precedential opinion. Has the law been clear enough about any distinction between the standard of review as between termination of parental rights and transfer, in light of the fact that a transfer is not considered as a permanent severing of the relationship between parent and child?
The distinction on the standard of review, well, because They both affect a substantial right. And bear with me, that's embedded in my brief. The factual findings of both is clear error. Due process on both would be a question of law, which is de novo. The substantial right is where I think it becomes a bit different, because a termination of parental rights is irreversible, where a transfer of permanent legal and physical custody is not. I shouldn't say it's irreversible. In very rare cases, a TPR can be reversed, but a TPLPC is not reversible. So in that way, or is reversible. So in that way, there is, I think there's the assumption that it is not as, because it's not as permanent, it's not as serious. And so
I
I
guess
know at the district court level, it's difficult to use TPR case law to persuade the district court.
right. I guess that's my question goes to whether, in light of the fact that they're different in terms of the permanency, whether more deference ought to be afforded to the district court in transfer cases, and whether we've articulated any distinction in that regard.
Insofar as it permanently severs the relationship, it is different. On the ground, it's the same. Because unless there is a robust contact agreement in a TPLPC, there's still no contact. The parental responsibilities, because it's legal and physical custody, the parental relationship is practically as much severed as it would be in a TPR. Without the adoption, if there's not, like I said, if there's not contact, there's no parental relationship anymore. So,
Ms. Thompson, haven't
yes.
we already issued a precedential decision in the matter of the welfare of the child of DLD in 2015? That's 865 Northwest 2nd, 315, that dealt with the transfer of legal and physical custody and articulated a standard of review where we review the factual findings for clear error and the finding of a statutory basis for an abuse of discretion.
In DLD. I apologize, Your Honor. I do not have that at my fingertips. I don't know that it was a transfer. My recollection is that DLD was a TPR. I in researching for this case, I found very, very little precedent that was TPLPC. I would like to talk about this appellant's due process rights and then the question of freedom of contract as well.
Can I ask you before you move on to that, just
Certainly.
what effect, if any, should we or what weight should we give to the fact that your client didn't appeal from the CHIPS adjudication? So some of the issues that I imagine you're going to touch on with regard to due process relate to, for example, notice of the emergency protective care hearing, and that's essentially a separate proceeding from the permanency petition that was ultimately filed to transfer legal and physical custody, and your client didn't appeal from the CHIPS adjudication. So I'm wondering if there, what your thoughts are on that, and if you can point us to any cases that would say one way or the other whether you can now litigate due process issues relating to the CHIPS proceeding on appeal from the permanency proceeding.
I would say a couple of things, Your Honor. In this situation, my client chose to proceed pro se. So, in that regard, I would ask the court to give less weight to the fact that he did not appeal the CHIPS proceeding. I would also say, again, from a very practical standpoint, we function here when a child is out of the home under a timeline. An appeal of a CHIPS adjudication does not stop a timeline from proceeding. What it does is prejudice and impact a parent in their progress on their case plan. Even holding a trial on a CHIPS adjudication slows a parent down in the progress on their case plan, and the time clock continues to tick. So we reach that 180-day mark of the permanency progress review hearing. They find that trial was just held. The decision just came out from the CHIPS adjudication 2 weeks earlier. Parent hasn't made any progress on the case plan because there hasn't been an adjudication, and now we're 6 months down the road. So even when a parent is represented, it is under the umbrella of the timeline, dishearteningly impractical to appeal a CHIPS adjudication because of the timeline. When a parent proceeds pro se, they may not even be aware of the availability of an appeal of a CHIPS adjudication. So I would ask that the court give, in this situation, give that lack of an appeal of the CHIPS adjudication a little weight. Also, there was a question of notice, I believe, as to the CHIPS trial. I believe that was held in default. And I'm sure Mr. Hay will address that. But I know my client has brought up the question of neither parent had appeared at that. And so the CHIPS adjudication was by default. But I would ask the court give that little weight. And back to the lack of notice, there was the child was placed under a law enforcement hold. And so technically, the agency did not need to file an ex parte motion for protective care. However, the parent was not noticed of the law enforcement hold, though the agency had notice or had knowledge of his whereabouts. So he had no knowledge of the law enforcement hold, no knowledge of the emergency protective care hearing, and then was finally served with the petition and summons days after the EPC hearing was held, after the child had already been had a prima facie finding made that he was in need of protective care. So throughout the case, without proper notice to the parent, without communication from social services, there was not, the court couldn't possibly make valid findings that reasonable efforts were made or that it was in the child's best interest if the parent was not able to effectively argue for his position if his rights were being compromised.
Ms. Thompson, do we have to reverse the district court's CHIPS adjudication in order to rule in your favor with regard to your argument as to the ultimate order transferring legal and physical custody?
No, Your Honor. A permanency matter is a completely separate matter. In fact, it's a separate court file at the district court level. So we are here today appealing only the transfer of permanent legal and physical custody. The CHIPS adjudication is separate.
So and I guess why I ask is because at the beginning of your argument, you raised some concerns regarding the district court's reliance on facts underlying the CHIPS matter. And so if you're not challenging the CHIPS adjudication, why would it be error, even with the due process issues that you're raising, as to the CHIPS matter, why would it be error for the district court in the permanency matter, the separate matter that you just said, to have relied on those facts?
I will say this. My client did not appeal the CHIPS adjudication. The 20-day time had passed for that. It's not available to us to appeal that. For lack of a better phrase, it is what it is. The issue here is that the court relied on old information at the time of its findings of best interests, primarily information from 2022, not necessarily from the CHIPS adjudication underlying this case, but from information from 2022, because it's stated throughout the record here that the social worker did not have contact with the parent, and that the child's health and behavioral issues were ongoing while in placement. So even in the agency's brief here, they go back to the prior CHIPS matter, talking about type 1 diabetes and marijuana use, et cetera, and relying on that. And in the court's order here, transferring permanent legal and physical custody, they're relying on that old data. Where
would you agree that the medical issues ultimately, as I read the TLPC order, that they're kind of the heart of the district court's reasoning in transferring legal custody, that the district court set aside some concerns regarding physical abuse and things like that. But I mean, even by your client's own testimony, as it's summarized in the order, there was an admission that your client was placing the burden of medication compliance upon the child, and that the child hadn't been totally medication compliant. And so the biggest concern isn't one way of reading the order, the biggest concern being with regard to making sure the child got medication properly for the type 1 diabetes.
I'm running out of time here, Your Honor, but the medical issue was an issue. The concern of my client is, first, the child was old enough to have had some level of responsibility for his own medication. However, it was not resolved or mitigated in foster care. He was having the same issues in foster care. He was being hospitalized for his type 1 diabetes and his medication management in foster care. So to say that it was in his best interests, that there was any difference or any advantage to being removed from his father's custody, does not follow the facts of this case. At the time of trial, which precedent tells us, the decision for permanency has to be made on the status and the best interest of the parent and child at the time of trial, not their past history, but on the day of trial. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent. I believe you're still muted.
I'm sorry. Michael Haig, County Attorney's Office, and I task county. Good morning, and counsel, and may it please the court. We ask that the court affirm the district court. This is a matters that I do not believe it's a fair to say rests on old facts. The facts before the district court were fresh. They were recurring. They were unresolved. And the child had issues that the child and father had issues that were resulting in the child's separation, leaving the home and being away from his father. And his father basically acquiescing in the child being away. And that happened in July of 2022, when the county did the first CHIPS. They recurred in November of 22. When the second CHIPS was brought. And the district court, in its findings throughout that CHIPS, including the exhibits, the court records from the EBC hearing, to the admit-deny hearing, to the pretrial conference, and all these subsequent reviews, documented carefully, procedurally, and substantively. The aim to deal with the antecedents to the child separating from the home.
Let me ask you, Leah, your opposing counsel raises a point that in 2022, father was being, some of the medication issues with regard to the child were sort of put as father's fault. Those medication issues continue while the child is in foster care. So then why is it still relevant to fault the father from conduct in 2022 when that conduct, the medication issues were still a problem while he was in foster care?
Counsel's account is a very narrow reading of the record. And the record shows that the foster parent worked very closely with the medical provider and the child and developed an understanding that that child did not understand the computations connected to that disease and how to manage it. And so she took him under his under her wing to educate herself, educate the boy better. Father did not do that. The record does not show that father executed that part of parenting. And it's up to the boy. He's old enough. He can do it. He was not mature enough to do it. And when you look at exhibits 18 and 19, the diagnostic information about that boy and his functioning, you get a deeper picture that there, from his standpoint, there was a breakdown. There were significant impairments in that home. That boy is the only one who came to the table to problem solve this case. The district court and the parties worked hard to engage father, come to the table, help do problem solving, get each other's perspectives, and let's build, look forward and build on strengths and overcome what's leading that boy to run away. And that didn't happen throughout the case. Dad took the other approach that judge dismissed this. These are not, they don't come under your power. It's solely a parental prerogative. So I ask that the court consider that because it does show an important part of the picture. We still don't know Dad's perspective. He still hasn't come to the table. It's been set for him. Everything's prepared. He won't sit down at the table.
Mr. Hay, you would agree that the child who testified at the permanency hearing denied feeling unsafe in his father's home. He didn't want to lose contact with his father. He testified that he believed things had improved with his father, and that's something that others testified to as well. To Ms. Thompson's point, why should we conclude that the district court didn't clearly err in determining that the statutory basis for a transfer of legal custody was met here, and on top of that, that the transfer was in the child's best interest?
Well, the judge was able to see that boy. was able to assess that boy's credibility in the face of his father and assess his connections to his father. And the judge was in the best position to evaluate, is he being straightforward in light of other evidence in the records saying things were not good. There were issues. That boy talks about in the diagnostic assessment, statements he made to obtain diagnosis, the kind of statements people make to get treatment.
The district court didn't discredit the district court didn't discredit the child's testimony, right? I mean, the district court actually started its discussion of the child's testimony by acknowledging that the child was competent to testify, and there's definitely no explicit finding that the district court discredited the child's testimony. In fact, the district court went out of its way to point out where the child acknowledged past misrepresentations.
And I don't have the finding number, but then read the court's findings of what the guardian ad litem testified to. And she offered the view that he's portraying things not quite as other things he's said. So on the issue of credibility, I don't think the court clearly erred. Rather, it took a hard look at the full picture. And that impairment found in the chips that is resulting in the risky, the unsafe conditions, the separation, hadn't changed at all. So in
you're right in pointing out the guardian ad litem's testimony findings as the guardian ad litem that the district court found the child's testimony was conflicted with prior reports and agreed with the guardian ad litem that the circumstance of the proceeding might have affected his responses. You know, it's also a finding of the court that the child expressed the desire to remain with the custodians, right?
Well, absolutely. And not just that, but there was a lot of evidence about the functional improvements that others had seen in that boy in a different environment where there was consistency and routine in his education, his medical, his personal functioning, and he still used marijuana, and they dealt with that, and the recovery specialist was set up, and they got him motivated. His motivation has changed. He's not talking about the racing thoughts, the depression, the hopelessness, the scary thinking that's in a diagnostic assessment. And that was part of the case plan. People, let's get to the bottom of things. Dad just wouldn't come to the table and share from his knowledge and experience where is this problem. How can we look forward and bridge and strengthen and keep a healthy family? Dad chose a whole different way. And so we submit on the record as a whole, if there was a defect at the EPC, it resulted in no prejudice. At the very next hearing, Dad appeared. He didn't say, let's change and have the boy come home. I'll agree to a safety plan. He said, I want emancipation for the boy. He has not shown prejudice, a due process violation. Rather, the record shows a very careful, noticed, a heavily documented process. The argument that Father makes that the caseworker's work should be called perfunctory, I don't believe that the record supports that characterization. We got the record contains findings of numerous efforts by social worker Moeller to engage Dad, communicate with him, offer the case plan, do what the law says, the statutory law says to problem solve, serious, conflictual, complex problems, come to the table, put our heads together, have the court oversight, solve the problems. No change through the case. Thank you.
Although your time has expired, I do have a quick question regarding the status at the time of the hearing as to the ongoing relationship, even though there's a transfer of rights. Sometimes there's accommodations made so that the parent can still have ongoing access to the child. What does the record tell us, if anything, about that in this case?
Well, the record shows that the permanent providers, they want to support that boy and father having healthy relationship, a safe relationship. I do not have an update for the court to share since the district court proceedings have concluded, but the record shows they have relationship with the between the families before the CHIPS, after the CHIPS, grandparents, extended family, and that went to desirability, suitability, fitness.
Thank you. Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes you can use for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. As far as a least restrictive and most home-like environment.
Again, just for the sake of the audio recording, if you could restate your name.
Certainly, Your Honor. Jennifer Thompson, Jennifer L. Thompson for appellant.
Thank you.
TMA. As far as the least restrictive and most home-like environment, the contact agreement that was established on the record with Father is lacking in providing that least restrictive and most home-like, and the child continues to want to return home.
Ms. Thompson, did Father visit with the child throughout either the CHIPS or the permanency proceeding?
It's my understanding that he had and has ongoing contact. I did not, again, he was pro se. So my understanding from speaking with my client is that he did. Whether the record reflects that, the record is not entirely accurate as far as the level of contact between my client and his child.
just asked because I thought there was a finding by the district court that father chose not to engage in any supervised visitation throughout the proceedings before the district court.
Yes, and it's my client's position that his level of contact was not entirely accurately reflected in the record. I will say that counsel for the agency's entire argument here points to my client's argument regarding the lack of freedom to contract. And I know this is an odd question to bring about in a child protection matter and a permanency matter, but I think it's an interesting one. And I think there is a large group of people who espouse this belief. And there's a large body of information on the internet that is coaching people to challenge the child protection system in this way. And so I am asking the court to hear me out and to make a ruling on this. The come to the table argument. We are here, we've got your child, come talk to us, is a coercive, not voluntary in any way, plenary power exercise on the part of a government agency. It is, parents are consistently told, you have a choice to participate in services. If you don't, we'll come back with a court order and take your child. And that's the flat reality of day-to-day child protective services. In this case, my client was told, participating in all of these services is voluntary. Come work on a case plan with us. And he said, I don't want to. I want to manage my child's education and his medical needs. And consistently, time after time, went to court and was told, you really don't have a choice. We're going to keep your child in our custody and ultimately take custody from you.
Are you aware of any court in the country, federal or state, that has attempted to reconcile the contention about freedom of contract with the countervailing issue of the best interests of the child?
I think that the best interest of the child is so subjective and nebulous. It's argued from each side.
Well, that may be so, but it's still the benchmark for child protection cases.
Understood.
It's been that way for quite a while, and it's clear, despite the parents' substantial constitutional rights to the relationship with the child and the authority over the child and all of that entailed, still the U.S. Supreme Court, our Supreme Court, virtually every appellate court that I'm aware of has recognized that when it comes to the best interests of the child, those tend to trump even that significant constitutional right. So why wouldn't that be even more so the case when it comes to what I would consider a lesser right, which would be the right to contract?
Sure. I will say, Your Honor, the best interest of the child, the reason I say that it is so nebulous is because both sides can argue different things are in the best interest of the child compellingly and with good reason and a good factual basis. And two things can simultaneously be in the best interest of a child. And it's very difficult to make that ultimate decision of what constitutes the ultimate best interest. However, for case law, Pierce versus Society of Sisters touched on it, and I'm running out of time, but Duchenne versus Sugarman, the right of the family to remain together without the coercive interference of the awesome power of the state encompasses the reciprocal rights of both parent and children. So it's not just a parent's rights at stake here. A child also has a right to his family, and that is in the best interest of a child. And I know I'm going over time a bit, but a child has a right to association with their family of birth. And so if anything, the right to be left alone applies to children too here. And so I do ask the court to say whether or not we as parents must be compelled to engage in so-called voluntary services when a government body with unfounded anonymous concerns stated intercedes in our lives. I would like to know the court's opinion on that.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. I appreciate the argument. Mr. Haig, thank you for your briefing in this matter and for your oral argument today. It's a difficult, these are always difficult and challenging cases, and we appreciate you handling the issues so professionally. We have taken the matter now under advisement. We will issue an opinion within the statutory period.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both, and have a good afternoon.
Have a great day. Thank you.